Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 13th day of June, 2020. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and there's just no way around it. This is a week where the breakdown and complete destruction of the United States, basically, if it wasn't obvious before, certainly moved into high gear and maybe into warp drive. And it's also pretty clear by now, at least to those with eyes to see, that we're getting some clues about the shape of things to come. Certainly if the leftists continue to get their way. Case in point, obviously, is Seattle. So let's start our look at some of the big events of the week right there. In this case, courtesy of a piece by Michael Snyder, who gives us a taste of what the French Revolution might look like, played out on the left coast. Protesters in Seattle, he said, decided they were going to give us a living, breathing example of how the world should really operate. The police were completely kicked out of a 6-square-block area of downtown Seattle, and armed guards were posted at all the entrances to what's been called the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, or CHAZ, in order to make sure that their utopia wouldn't be interrupted by, you know, the real world. At first, people were dancing and singing in the streets. Free food was being passed out to everyone. Gardens were started, and free movies were played at night under the stars. It was such a glorious beginning for CHAZ, until, that is, the real world and major problems began to develop. Starting with when the protesters, who wanted to show everyone how compassionate they could be, invited Seattle's homeless population to share their free food. Turns out that the freeloaders grabbed more free food than they should have, which in turn created a crisis, prompting the oh-so-tolerant ones to start begging for food. Well, if it's vegan enough, anyway. Please, said one of them in a tweet, we need more food to keep the area operational. If possible, bring vegan meat substitutes, fruits, oats, soy products, etc., anything to help us eat. Well, almost anything. As Snyder puts it, yeah, if you live near CHAZ and you have extra food laying around, there are some really hungry radicals that would appreciate your help. But certainly you don't want to bring them anything that would be heavily processed or, for crying out loud, contain meat products, because that would just make them very angry and might even set off a riot. But it's not just the looming food shortage that might represent a problem. The residents of CHAZ are also dealing with a developing leadership crisis, because now that all the police are gone, it was just a matter of time before some strongman stepped in and took charge, and that turns out to be a heavily armed rapper named Raz Simone, who, along with his entourage, have already claimed the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone as their territory. And the oh-so-peaceful AK-47-toting radical is warning all those under his command that what they're now facing is, quote, war. And as the story here summarizes it, there you go. It only took 2 days for Seattle's autonomous zone to descend into chaos. Seattle Police Chief Carmen Best told reporters on Thursday that, quote, rapes, robberies, all sorts of violent acts are occurring in the area, and we're not able to get to them. And lest the leftists there discount everything she says completely, some of them ought to at least be aware that the Seattle police chief is in fact a black female. Other far-left politicians in the area, though, were quite a bit more blind to the reality. Far-left Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin, says a piece from the Gateway Pundit, lashed out at President Trump on Thursday evening after he dared to tell the nutcases there to take back your city now, and if you don't do it, I will. He said, this is not a game. These ugly anarchists must be stopped immediately. Move fast. Which she, of course, did, but as you'd probably expect, in the wrong direction, throwing her support behind the anarchist act that she labeled as patriotism, and of course the most far-left New America with a K sense. The wannabe Jacobin insisted that, quote, CHAZ is not a lawless wasteland of anarchist insurrection, unquote. Instead, she called the domestic terrorists there peaceful, and, said the unhinged mayor, and I'm quoting from the piece, the city won't allow the military to come into Seattle and clean the place up, and instead they enabled the terrorists by bringing in porta-potties and other supplies the snowflakes don't tend to think about until they start jonesing for them. Given, as just about every pundit has already observed, we've entered a very disturbing new chapter in U.S. history, and events are beginning to spiral out of control. Add to that the complete breakdown of the food supply chain and the fact that over 40 million people, and gaining, are out of work at this point. And it's not hard to make a pretty good case that the economic and societal pain is only just beginning. But we should never forget the old adage, which is true, that if you really want to know what's going on, follow the money. Or the fake money in this case. The Fed's Open Market Committee revealed more of their incredible brilliance midweek, and while what happened is really no surprise, the reaction almost makes it look like markets are starting to wake up to reality. Now, I know that's a stretch, but at least let's take a look at where things are today. And just to set the stage, we'll start with a few headlines, starting with reaction immediately after the FOMC's big reveal. Chaos is coming, warns Hugh Hendry, as bullion, bonds, and big tech are bid, while the dollar and the Dow got dumped. From CNBC, or Tout TV, stocks are set to plunge at the open, and they did, on concerns about the second wave of the big bad virus, booga booga booga, and Dow futures were down 900 points as that one was published. It ended up down about 1,800 points. The S&P plunged about 6%, and it was called the worst market rout since the March crash. Oh, not to worry, though. We had a dead cat bounce on Friday. CNBC's subheadline says that it's concerns about a second wave of coronavirus cases. And isn't it amazing, folks, that as things reopen, like in Texas and Florida, the punishment is being doled out. But part of the carnage, they admit, has to do with the fact that investors, sick, are continuing to try to digest the Federal Reserve's updates on economic and monetary policy. What did they actually say? Well, therein lies the rub. As Zero Hedge summarized it Wednesday afternoon, Powell has claimed that the Fed will never hold back support for the economy, even if asset prices are too high. Huh, does that mean they're going to continue to backstop and buy everything? Well, noting that others have said recently that soaring asset prices may end up reaching a point where the Fed might be forced into some kind of comeuppance. That question did come up during the FOMC press conference, says Zero Hedge, and here's what Powell responded. See if you can make sense of this, folks. We're not focused on moving asset prices in a particular direction at all. Oh, really? Well, that's news. It's just we want markets to be working. But no, folks, letting the economy function as a free market was never actually on the table. And partly as a result of what we've done, they are working.
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
He said that a couple of times, as if saying it over and over again might actually make it true. But his conclusion, notes this piece, was ominous. Quote, we want investors to price in risk like markets should. Well, that would be a radical change from what they've been doing, wouldn't it? And he explained that the Fed would never hold back support for the economy because it thinks asset prices are too high. In other words, a bubble. We would be prepared to tolerate, or should I say welcome, very low readings on unemployment without worrying about inflation. Unquote, and huh? Well, I can't help but think it certainly looks like they've been planning and preparing and literally working hard for hyperinflation. Zero Hedge summarizes it this way, and this makes more sense than what Powell said. The Fed will never voluntarily pop the asset bubble it's created by unleashing trillions of dollars in liquidity, loans, and guarantees, not to mention purchasing corporate bonds, as all of that would somehow hurt job seekers, even though, as they've been observing, companies that managed to load up on debt thanks to the Fed's emergency actions did somehow use the proceeds not to retain workers. In fact, they ended up firing millions, but instead to pay dividends. Oh, and let's not forget, pump the stock prices for their own board of directors and CEOs' benefits. Here then is one cogent summary of the Fed's actions. Sven Henrich of Northman Trader says, today was an historic day. The Fed has fully embraced its capitulation to everything markets, and it implicitly encourages asset price bubbles while lying about its role in exacerbating wealth inequality. It'll keep printing, therefore, with no end in sight. Oh, and they have no exit strategy. And Tyler Durden's summary follows that up with one really good final point. With even established financial commentators now admitting it's U.S. monetary policy that's been the culprit for the unprecedented wealth and income divide, what with the Fed enabling massive wealth accumulation by holders of their assets, even as real wages have barely budged in the past 30 years, the Fed was actually asked if his policies have contributed to this phenomenon. His answer, quote, inequality has been rising for four decades, and this shift is not related to monetary policy. Well, says Zero Hedge, 2 points here. One, the Fed has been around for 108 years, and two, he is right. And the reason for that unprecedented increase in inequality, as they explained 5 years ago, and your host concurs, is that when Nixon ended the gold standard, unleashing an era of unprecedented monetary growth, which just happened to benefit only one segment of U.S. society, the 1%, it did manage to crush everyone else. Fiat money printing does tend to benefit only the printers. And they provided a graph showing the income inequality between the 1% at the top and the 90% at the bottom, going back through the Fed century, which pretty well, unequivocally, makes that point. So what happened next? Well, Tyler Durden puts it this way in a story from this morning. With stocks tumbling, it was only a matter of time before Trump trotted out the plunge protectors. And sure enough, just minutes after the cash reopened, Steve Mnuchin dialed into CNBC where he said, quote, "We can't shut down the economy again amid growing fears of that second virus wave, booga, booga, booga." And just to get the Robin Hood traders extra pumped, the Treasury Secretary said they were going to pump another $1 trillion into the economy. Unfortunately, though, for the guy they're calling the stock market president, unlike previous Mnuchin appearances, this time the market was largely oblivious to his message and still continued to trade near the worst levels of the session. 20 minutes later, gold jumps and stocks dump as Powell, that would be the Fed chairman, punctures the payrolls hype bubble. Somebody do something, they say, but wait a minute, Mnuchin already tried and evidently failed. Which brings me then to one of the better analyses I saw this morning, courtesy of Michael Every at Rabobank, who begins by quoting Investopedia about the role of central banksters. Yes, they carry out a nation's monetary policy, it says, and control its money supply, often mandated with maintaining low inflation and steady GDP growth. Oh, really, says Michael, that's how it works, is it? Well, at this point, anybody who can't see our real economic financial market paradigm is either foolish, ignorant, or willfully blind. The Fed, he says, has just admitted wages can't rise except by making very rich people very much richer for a long, long time. Then finally, they might start to go up. Perhaps. Moreover, the Fed has demonstrated yet again that it not only ignores asset bubbles, it will, quote, never hold back support for the economy, even if asset prices are too high, unquote, but that it wants those bubbles. How, he asks, can this end well? Why, look, he notes at the uneven distribution of stock holdings. I'll skip over most of the numbers, but suffice it to say that as of this year, 50% of the U.S. stock market is owned by the top 1% of society. Could we please, he continues, just have the intellectual honesty to admit the system as it exists today functions to give more money to ultra-rich people? This is no longer a free market system. Water doesn't find its own level. It's channeled through canals cut by an establishment, and some fields are watered very well, others left arid. This, he said, is not capitalism, as anyone teaches or models it, where money is made from productively investing in making things. It is speculative financial capitalism, where money is made by watching money being made by central banksters, which is then channeled into the stocks of firms who often don't make things. But hey, your host notes, they often do control things, witness Gulag to Facebook and Twitter. So given the homilies that central banksters are now coming out with when it concerns inequality, one could even say it's oligarchy excreting noblesse oblige. Nowadays, in other words, it boils down to central banksters saying, let them eat stocks. Every's not the first to note that most real innovations today have to do with chicanery and financial manipulations. What we didn't get from Powell, he said, is a clear message aimed at the public about improving infrastructure, national security, reducing inequality, and the like. Instead, the Fed described a bleak future U.S. economic landscape where many millions of jobs may never come back, and the response is still to channel more money to the rich via continuing asset bubbles. Meanwhile, he notes, and far from unrelated, in the formerly great city of Seattle, six city blocks have now been seized by insurrectionists. And there does seem to be a message here. When the rich get everything for free, why shouldn't everyone else? Well, when you look at it that way, he says, it's a good question. Well, your host has to admit here, the banksters steal very cleverly, and on a huge, literally international scale to boot. But interestingly, the result is still the same. Burned out, vacated buildings, stores looted, and homes and families destroyed. They're just more willing to take their time and do it on a grander scale. If you really want to believe, concludes Michael Every, that the Fed is not aware of its own complicity in all this, then one has to assume we're watching a man struggling to eat soup with a fork. It's embarrassing, messy, stupid, and ridiculous. Except in this case, the man gets paid billions of dollars for as long as it takes him not to eat the soup. Try to remember that. I feel sorry, he continues, for those that have to give a traditional vanilla write-up of what the Fed is doing. It's hard to do so and maintain any self-respect. One day, this will all come crashing down in epic ruin, and people will have to look at themselves in the mirror or tell their kids what they did when all this was going on. Yet, for all those who don't have to play along with this charade, the Fed is on hold until the end of 2022 at least. They'll do $120 billion a month of QE, split 80-40 between treasuries and mortgage-backed securities, and there's at least yet no hint of negative rates or yield curve control. Analyst Bill Blaine seems to concur in a piece he entitled, "The Illusion is Wearing Thin," and begins by saying the Fed did exactly what was expected, nay, demanded. Asset purchase volumes will be maintained, while rates will remain near zero for the next 2 years. Hallelujah! The market shrugged aside indications of a second virus wave across parts of the U.S. and Europe, but if Fed head Jay Powell had said anything else, there would have been a hissy fit mini taper tantrum. So the dominant force on markets will remain central banksters juicing them, and with it the associated distortion. The immediate lesson for investors is keep buying, because the Fed and other central banksters have got your back. After all, they can't afford for markets to stumble. Problem is, little the Fed said is likely to change the reality of the coming recession. He still isn't using the D word, though, although again I note that markets do seem to be getting almost a clue today. But it's still coming, and there now is a new and growing dimension to the crisis. He's talking about the insurrectionists, folks, with names like Antifa and Black Lives Matter. The reason? Unrest is a political issue, it's intended to be, and politics, he says, have a seriously underestimated ability to roil markets. And since we all know the economic looting will continue, and of course will take a while to truly play out, let me introduce just a couple more stories along these same lines from Schiff Gold. Peter Schiff, who's been warning that the real crash will be a dollar crash, says that U.S. living standards are about to be squeezed as never before, and in that, he even quotes a Yale economist. A good one in this case, Stephen Roach, published by Bloomberg, echoes the warning about the dollar's demise, saying the era of the U.S. dollar's exorbitant privilege as the world primary reserve currency is coming to an end. It was inevitable, folks, but it's still going to be really, really ugly. Roach says the decline of the dollar will have three major implications. A, and obviously, it will be inflationary, perhaps even stagflationary. All of that means even more unemployment, as well as the possibility of hyperinflation. Secondly, says Roach, the U.S. trade deficit will soar even higher, quote, effectively taxing beleaguered U.S. consumers. And finally, he asks the question, in the face of Washington's poorly timed wish for financial decoupling from China, who will fund the saving deficit of a nation that's finally lost that exorbitant privilege? Michael Snyder at the Economic Collapse blog writes, no, the U.S. economy will definitely not be returning to normal. In fact, things will soon get even worse. And he begins by noting that the perpetually optimistic OECD is now admitting global economic activity as a whole will be way down in 2020, although he does say a 6 or 7% worldwide decline in GDP, which is what they're talking about, is definitely not normal. And furthermore, if the OECD projection turns out to be accurate, we'll be talking about a global depression by the end of the year. 25,000 U.S. stores will close by the end of the year. We're looking at food price inflation, of course. 40 million plus Americans, and more to come, are already out of work. And at this point, he too quotes Fed Chairman Powell, who says, now get this, quote, I don't think that the Great Depression is a good example or likely outcome for a model of what's happening here at all. I really don't, he said. There are so many fundamental differences, unquote. And yeah, here I have to agree with Michael Snyder. Powell's right. This isn't going to be very similar to the Great Depression of the 1930s. In the long run, what we're currently witnessing will be far, far worse. After all, folks, we've never had as much debt as we're seeing today. And back in the 1930s, among other things, Americans had family farms to fall back on. Finally, from Charles Hugh Smith, who writes that the greatest depression and the reverse wealth effect we're now seeing are unstoppable. There's no exit, he says, from the greatest depression. And he's explained why in the past, by the way, so has your host, but he'll try to summarize this, he says, and I think he did a pretty good job, as simply as possible. Number one, the global economy's cost structure has been fatally distorted by central bankster policies of inflating asset bubbles and reducing interest rates to near zero. Number two, earnings from labor have stagnated or even eroded since the era of globalization and financialization starting around the year 2000. Number three, everything costs too much, i.e. is no longer affordable from earnings alone. So the only way to maintain the current costly lifestyle is to borrow money and use it to pay current expenses, which is true for every sector, household, corporate, and government. Number four, as a result, everyone now needs every dollar of income just to pay expenses, including interest and principal on rising debts. There are no slack or buffers in the entire system at all. Number five, this can be visualized, and here's an analogy I've used before too, as a row of dominoes. Once the first one falls, every domino will topple. And he gives a pretty decent example. A worker's laid off. They can no longer afford to go to a favorite restaurant. And the restaurant's expenses, of course, are so high that it can't survive on reduced customer traffic, which, by the way, the COVID-1984 pandemic has exacerbated dramatically. If they open at all, they may be allowed to have 10 or maybe 25% of their previous capacity. And some leftist cities are making them install costly, stupid stuff to boot, increasing their expenses. Result? They close, eventually. The commercial landlord's expenses are so high he can't afford to lower rents, but since no businesses can afford those high rents, the space is empty, the landlord goes bust, the bank that's holding the mortgage then has to absorb a staggering loss, but hey, this was the point anyway. The too-big-to-fail and certainly too-big-to-jail banksters will eventually own everything. But still, the property is no longer worth much because a building without tenants is just a money pit of expenses and no income. So why not? Just let it be looted and turn into more of the urban landscape, and the whole system continues to auger in. As he puts it, the once valuable restaurant business is now worth zero, the once valuable commercial property is also worth zero, and the falling dominoes trigger a reverse wealth effect, which will not stop, meaning we're entering the greatest depression because there's no exit. Either the phantom wealth of asset bubbles completely vanishes, or the phantom purchasing power of fiat currency vanishes, or both, but they still lead to the same destination, systemic collapse. On then next to the People's Republic of Chicago, which has its own corrupt comrades in control. After Chicago experienced one of their worst and deadliest weekends of violence in recent memory, you'd never guess, though, by reading the coverage in the WAPO and New York Times, as Zero Hedge puts it, we see a particularly disturbing example that's now emerged, courtesy of a leaked recording of a meeting between the almost unbelievably disgusting mayor there, Lori Lightfoot, and her own city council, or one of the mayor's chief critics, but also a far-left fellow Democrat, accused her of not doing enough to quell the violence. Here next, a bit of the transcript, courtesy of the CBS Chicago affiliate, where Raymond Lopez says, quote, "When downtown is in lockdown, our neighborhoods are next, and our failure to fully get ready for what's going on in the neighborhoods, we're seeing this destruction, and we're thinking that it's going to somehow end tonight. We have seen where, in other cities, this has gone on for days, and we need to come up with a better plan for days, at least for the next 5 days, to try and stabilize our communities," said Lopez. He noted that some parts of the back of the yards and Brighton Park neighborhoods in his ward had become, quote, "a virtual war zone," and added, "We can't expect our police, and I don't fault them at all, to be able to control this. Half our neighborhoods are already obliterated. It's too late." And he went on to say he feared looters would eventually start targeting homes after ransacking businesses throughout the city. And here, folks, your host has to note, hey, he's exposed Lori Lightfoot's plan, along with the others that are pulling her strings. Back to the quote, "Once they're done looting and rioting and whatever's going to happen tonight, God help us, what happens when they start going after residents, going into the neighborhoods, once they start trying to break down people's doors, if they think they've got something," he said. "We know that people are here to antagonize and incite, and you've got them all pumped tonight, today. They're not going to go to bed at 8 o'clock. They're going to turn their focus onto the neighborhoods. I've got gangbangers," he said, "with AK-47s walking around right now, just trying to settle some scores. What are we going to do? And what do we tell residents, other than good faith people, stand up? It's not going to be enough," said Lopez. And when he finished speaking, Lightfoot at first declined to respond, tried to move on to other aldermen, but Lopez then demanded an answer. "It's not something you ignore," he said. "This is a question that I have, which is when things got profane. I think you're 100% full of shit, is what I think," said Lightfoot, infuriating Lopez, who responded, "F you, then. Who are you to tell me I'm full of shit?" he said. "Maybe you should come out and see what's going on." Well, folks, I can't help but think a lot of these people already know what's going on, and they're thrilled. And we'll pick it up there when we get back.
Hit your next door neighbor, but don't forget to say great.
Back now to the second segment for this evening. I'm still your host, Mark Call. And if there's a consistent theme over the last week or even the last couple of months, it undoubtedly has to do with the big lie. So let's start off this segment with one of the biggest liars out there, at least among the deep state's three-letter agencies. And the latest in-your-face example comes courtesy of the New York Post, which tells us that the FBI is now warning that white supremacists and racist terrorists, which should mean Antifa, but don't worry, folks, it doesn't to them, pose the greatest risk of violence, says the primary agency running the coup. This, according to a new intelligence, SIC, bulletin sent out by the federal bunglers of investigation to local law enforcement, as well as the Department of Achtung Homeland Security and the National Counterterrorism Center, but barely mentions Antifa, much less their other communist-funded co-conspirators, as potential violent groups, even though federal lawmakers have actually called for the former to be labeled as a terror group. The report blames militias and right-wing racist groups who they say are seeking to start a second American Civil War by targeting those oh-so-peaceful protesters. The Gateway Pundit's Jim Hoft gets it right. Somehow, he says, the FBI must have missed the last couple of weeks. They slept through the Black Lives Matter and Antifa riots, where hundreds of stores were looted and destroyed in places like Minneapolis, Chicago, and New York City. St. Louis looked like a war zone. But despite all the mass looting and violence by the far left, Chris Wray's FBI sent out a memo warning that it's no, none of those, but white supremacists that pose the greatest risk of violence. As he puts it, what a disgrace. But that's an understatement. Quote, militia extremists who advocate a belief in the superiority of the white race have sought to bring about a second civil war, often referred to as a boogaloo, by intentionally instigating violence at First Amendment protected activities. Unquote. Wait a minute. You know what's really surprising in that? Did the FBI actually just admit that there are some things still protected by the Bill of Rights? Well, for some people anyway. All right, enough of this, folks. But down somewhere inside here, the New York Post notes that the document only even mentions the existence of Antifa once in a footnote, according to the report, noting that some anarchists self-identify as Antifa. Good grief. No wonder the United States is coming apart at the seams. They've had help from the instigators at the FBI, at least since they killed John F. Kennedy. Not to mention Randy Weaver's son and wife, a bunch of people at a church in Waco, and, well, hopefully by now you know the rest of the story, even if they keep lying about them. No doubt Comey, McCabe, Brennan, and Clapper are just laughing their foul heads off over this one. One major Orwellian form of the big lie, of course, has to do with rewriting history. Speaking of which, HBO has caved to the demands of the far-left out-of-control mob and removed Gone with the Wind from its platform. As the BBC reported, HBO Max said the 1939 film was, quote, a product of its time and depicted, quote, ethnic and racial prejudices that were wrong then and are wrong today, unquote. And, you know, maybe that was the point of art anyway, you blithering idiots. The controversy centers around the depiction of slave characters who are content to stay with their owners after slavery is abolished, something that did happen and is historically accurate, said Paul Joseph Watson's coverage. Oh, and by the way, folks, take a look around today. You'll see slaves that are just itching to stay right there on the plantation. Oh, but it's completely verboten even to hint at that now, isn't it? Because the slaves don't want to be told the truth, don't you know? Why, just try asking one why they're wearing their placebo burkas and see what kind of a response you get. And the film's removal is even a bit more poignant when people point out that by deleting the movie, HBO has also erased from its memory banks the first black female to ever win an Oscar, Hattie McDaniel. So let's be clear here. The idiots on parade that claim to be so anti-racism are doing what the other races couldn't accomplish themselves, removing her name from the list of Oscar winners. And, of course, doing precisely what George Orwell's Ministry of Truth sought to do, and that's rewrite history. Breitbart's John Nolte was one of those who pointed out that John Ridley, 2013 Oscar winner for the screenplay of 12 Years a Slave, has not only been calling for the blacklisting of that film that won 8 Academy Awards and is still, whether they like it or not, the most popular movie ever made, he's also calling for the blacklisting of a film where the first female black actress ever won an Oscar. And, as Nolte points out, let's not forget that 73% of black people love Gone with the Wind because this moral panic is not about giving people, whether they're black or white, what they actually want. It's instead about the opposite. Fascism, silencing, scarlet lettering, and blacklisting, he says. And it's also about seeing just how far bullies like Ridley can push corporate, public, private partnership fascist America using the tools of emotional blackmail and outright terror. Here your host has to hearken back to something I remember talking about and seeing over a decade ago. And that was a number of idiot school boards across the United States deciding that Mark Twain's anti-racist classic, Huckleberry Finn, should be removed from curricula because they were too stupid to understand Mark Twain's point. And that was even before the further dumbing down of Commie Core. And besides, he actually used the N-word in print. Folks, this was one of the most powerful books I ever read when it comes to understanding what racism really is, and at the same time isn't. And I have a strong suspicion that if more people, black and white, had read Huckleberry Finn when they were in high school, we wouldn't be seeing so many cities looted and burned to the ground today. But then again, if you really understand the goal here, that's the point. Nolte puts it this way. People like John Ridley and those who apply the pressure from above and below and fund the riots are not kidding. They're not looking to make a statement. They're not looking for attention. The woke fascist mob, he writes, is as serious as cancer. They are a cancer, and they will succeed in bullying corporations to blacklist their own content. And don't forget, if you own digital copies, fascist corporations like Amazon will even be able to quietly delete them. That process started back with web-connected Kindle. Understand that digital book burning's even easier than it is with the paper kind. For starters, absolutely nothing on the cloud is safe. And that includes things like photos, movies, and documents you thought were personally yours. John Nolte wraps up his comments this way, and pay close attention. Gone with the Wind is doomed. To Kill a Mockingbird is doomed. Huckleberry Finn is doomed. MASH is doomed, unless they re-edit it to make Frank Burns a hero. Baby, It's Cold Outside is doomed. Married with Children, Sanford and Son, All in the Family, Looney Tunes, and anything like them. Doomed, doomed, doomed. Get your hard copies now. Hide them away, too. And this is not a drill. Oh, if there's any good news at all in this latest abomination, it's the fact that at least a few Americans are waking up. Breitbart followed up with another story saying Americans rushed to snatch up physical copies of Gone with the Wind after the blacklisting. The film was the number one bestseller on Amazon early Wednesday morning, even though both the Blu-ray and regular DVD versions were sold out. But the banning and the blacklisting and the censorship and, yeah, the utter idiocy is just getting started today, folks. Instagram has banned users from posting federal crime statistics. That is, if they're politically incorrect. Writes Ethan Huff for Natural News, a graph comparing the number of black people killed by white people to the number of whites killed by blacks, whites killed by whites, and blacks killed by blacks, is no longer allowed on Instagram after the two Facebook-owned platform decided to dub things they don't want you to know as, ready for this, hate facts. Whoa, whoa, time out and full stop. How's that for a bit of truth and lying? Via censorship, of course. And ponder the irony, too. Hate facts, which is precisely what they do. compiled from data contained in the expanded homicide data, Table 6 of the FBI's 2018 crime report. The graph shows that only a very small percentage of black people are actually killed by white people. Meanwhile, the number of white people killed by black people is more than 10 times higher, but that is a verboten bit of knowledge because, of course, it is a hate fact. And if you, too, learn to hate facts, you'll appreciate being shielded from truth like that. Let's see if we can't carefully define hate facts. Those are things that would upset the snowflakes if they were allowed to hear them. And here may just be the perfect example of such, although I've seen this story multiple times now. Originally, it's the kind of thing you'd say, hey, this is conspiracy theory. But on the other hand, I certainly don't want to be a coincidence theorist either. And we'll get there next. Just how many of these incredibly unlikely coincidences do we need to put up with anyway? And we certainly don't want to forget one of America's most famous socialists and arguably evil presidents, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, once said, quote, in politics, nothing happens by accident. If it happens, you can bet it was planned that way. So here we go. We have now confirmed, says Mike Adams for Natural News, and he's not the first, that the Obama Foundation was tweeting about George Floyd back on May 17th, and that was more than a week before the day Floyd was reportedly killed on camera by police in an act of violence that at least allegedly sparked the worldwide riots we've grown accustomed to since then. George Floyd, it says, was killed on May 25th. So how is it that the Obama Foundation was tweeting about Floyd back on May 17th when nobody, well, outside of them anyway, even knew who he was? Unless, that is, the whole thing was planned in advance. Just like FDR suggested, some of us might even remember all that live reporting back on 9/11 about Building 7, which was already reported to have been collapsed, oops, even while it was still standing in the live feed from behind the reporters. And they don't want to talk about those recordings where the command was given to pull it, either. And at this point, Adams notes a number of interesting sidelights to the story. Once the first tweet accidentally went out showing a picture of Floyd, while he hadn't yet achieved sainthood, they couldn't very well delete it without raising suspicion. So, he says, they just left it up and are relying on Big Tech's proven record of being able to censor just about anything to make sure nobody learns the real truth that this was all planned in advance and then rigged as yet more public theater. Which brings me finally to a really great piece from Doug the Uncola Lynn via places like The Burning Platform and also, of course, Zero Hedge and others. It's entitled Conspiracy Theorists. No, this is different. Coincidence Theorists. And I got to admit, that's a great bit of terminology. Coincidence Theorists see all donut and no holes in the coronation of the cult. Over the past several decades, he begins, Americans have regularly viewed television dramatic episodes of political theater. And the use of the word episode there is especially appropriate because the dramatic scenes are sequential and they're continuously broadcast onto electronic screens. The drama, he writes, is designed to elicit emotion, foment anger, and either unite or divide the nation in order to ultimately effect change. Change of the most destructive variety, your host notes. These societal cataclysms that we're now experiencing could be naturally occurring. The result of certain trends like demographics, technology, modernization, education, or the lack thereof, centralization, economic inequality, political platforms, etc., etc., or even systemic corruption and ultimately civilizational decay. On the other hand, it could be also that the upheavals are directed in consonance with scripts written by an inner circle of powerful and evil people and in accord with the Hegelian dialectic. How citizens view the changes realized by the United States over the last few decades in particular will depend upon their interpretation of probabilities and outcomes, or rather, to the extent that they believe in either coincidence or conspiracy. And isn't that a great way to put it? Many believe that grand conspiracies are implausible, he notes, because ambitious schemes like that so often fail, and it's just inconceivable, at least to some folks, that scrupulous whistleblowers would refuse to expose the plans of these nasty, evil, powerful conspirators. And these objections do have a ring of truth, unless, of course, the powerful have only advanced those who've demonstrated allegiance, while at the same time they shun, banish, imprison, or expire those who won't fall in line. And perhaps that would go a long way to explaining the likes of Brennan, Clapper, Comey, and McCabe, and how they continue their book tours while Assange, Manafort, and Roger Stone remain under lock and key. Seth Rich and maybe Antonin Scalia, though, suffered worse fates. In intelligence circles, we know that control is administered via need-to-know, a.k.a. compartmentalization, and secured by constant surveillance. So just maybe, blackmail and threats to individuals and loved ones are the secret tactics that are used to compel loyalty. And it's not, folks, like we haven't heard example after example of that over the last few years, at least since the first Clinton regime. Even so, we do get an occasional decent U.S. prisoner, at least one that's willing to blow the whistle. Notably, most recently, folks like Eisenhower and John Kennedy, who certainly suffered for his candor. But in the process, they've drawn attention to a nebulous cult of power, acting as the political puppet masters and the pullers of purse strings. Or, as the famous automobile magnate Henry Ford once put it, "It's well enough that people of the nation do not understand our banking and monetary system, for if they did, I believe there would be a revolution before tomorrow morning." Unquote. It's also a fact that modern mass media today is owned by a handful of corporations, no doubt, and yeah, thank you Bill Clinton, and thus under the control of a few billionaires. Could it be possible, he says, that the cult would collude in order to advance media narratives that further their own interests while promoting agendas for their sole benefit? Of course it's possible, because after all, why wouldn't they? He gives a number of examples that make that point, like Bush the Younger, who delivered the Patriot Act and the so-called War on Terror, while the Obama regime gave us the NDAA, an open surveillance state, and the use of an enemies list that would have made even Tricky Dick Nixon blush. And from the time that Donald Trump descended the escalator in 2015, we've seen a continuum of fascinating and downright unfortunate events. Starting in the spring of 2016, when Broomhilda, and he calls her that, I think I've referred to her before as Hitlery, and her army of superdelegates swept the still smoking ashes of Bolshevik Bernie right into the fire pit. While in June of that year, the first of several FISA warrants against Trump was denied. That was followed by the infamous snakes on a plane meeting between Bill Clinton and then Attorney General Loretta Lynch mob, while Seth Rich, data analyst for the DNC, was murdered in Washington the very next month. But maybe the event that really ought to be focused on now was the one that took place in spring 2016 behind the nation's political stage, the inaugural ID 2020 summit, where, at UN headquarters in New York, they brought together over 400 people to discuss how to provide a unique digital identity to everyone on the planet, whether they want it or not, including 1.5 billion people currently living without any form of recognized ID. And indeed, events in 2020 have now brought that vision into better focus. Since the election of Trump, we've watched one political episode after another, from election hacking, impeachment, and now a plandemic. And just like regular commercial breaks interrupting a different kind of program, we saw the seemingly strategic school, church, synagogue, country music, and garlic festival shootings, all of which made for riveting and dramatic television. And rest assured, we will see COVID-19 back again. Yep, phase two has yet to be unleashed. In fact, says Doug Lynn, we're already seeing the previews as the country attempts to reopen. For example, a New York Times headline about how Texas, North Carolina, and Arizona are seeing rising numbers of cases as they try to reopen. They must not be wearing their masks. See, we told you so. Are all of these episodes naturally occurring as the result of a sick and dying nation? Or could they just be the magical media manifestations of another big lie? Is it possible, he says, we're being psychologically manipulated by powerful people in order to affect political change? To which all I can say is, duh, but wait a minute, that's the whole point here, because those that are coincidence theorists just aren't going to get it. Still, though, says Doug the Uncola Lynn, it would seem that only those under hypnosis could deny that current events in the U.S. have certainly been politicized. The Wall Street Journal, for example, has reported about how COVID-1984 has been politicized and increasingly exacerbates the so-called red-blue divide. And here he quotes them to say two-thirds of confirmed coronavirus cases are in states with Democratic governors. When states are measured by the sheer number of coronavirus cases, six of the top seven have far-left Democrat governors. And together, those six so-called blue states have about half of the nation's total cases, even though only about a third of its population. Coronavirus deaths, or at least presumed deaths, tell a similar story. Eight of the nine states with the most deaths due to the virus are states with Democrat governors, and when measured by deaths per capita, eight of the top nine states also have far-left governors. So he says, why is it that COVID-19, 84, has selectively attacked blue states more than red ones? Could be a matter of blue states having a higher density of population, or it could be just more plain old political chicanery, crookedness, and evil. And that may be the very same reason that pallets of bricks and other weapons have mysteriously materialized in those same cities, just prior to George Floyd protests. What an amazing series of coincidences. Indeed, he writes, every revolution starts with a spark, and don't forget that modern uprisings and lockdowns are now televised. Still, though, COVID-19, and here he puts the little registered trademark afterward, did accomplish a number of important leftist political objectives. They collapsed the economic everything bubble and deflected blame away from the banksters who blew it up. At the same time, they turned martial law into self-quarantine and abolished the First Amendment rights of American citizens, including the right to free exercise of religion, freedom of speech, and the right to peaceably assemble, all under the arbitrary mandates of socialist distancing. And additionally, even cash has been transitioned into a viral threat, thus paving the way to a new digital world order and the end of, well, what was left anyway, of privacy. And the televised outbreak even inflamed the fear and survival instincts of people in order to turn them on each other, while they massaged Wall Street and murdered Main Street. Oh, and it didn't hurt either that centralization has benefited Walmart and Amazon, while mom-and-pop businesses were suffocated, just like George Floyd, and then set on fire. So back to the central question. Are these changes the result of coincidence or conspiracy? Seriously, though, how could any of these long-desired objectives of the establishment not be the result of conspiracy? Because just like clockwork, as coronavirus was shown to be bullshit, the channel was changed one more time, this time to cities on fire. So whether by deception or never letting a perfectly good crisis go to waste, the George Floyd drama that's now assumed center stage will at least last until the next COVID-19 show returns next season. Now, wait a second. Here, folks, your host has to interject that that's quite a while. I tend to think there'll be another summer replacement show coming up real soon now, once the George Floyd riots even start to peter out. Still, though, no doubt about it, the urban riots could be used to further degrade American institutions, infrastructure, economy, and societal unity, or they could be exploited as a means to lock down entire regions of the country, or worse, as an excuse to declare national martial law. It's also possible we'll get a Fort Sumter moment in the suburbs, thus escalating civil warfare to new levels. And no, he says, it's not hard to imagine armed Caucasians defending their lives and property by mowing down George Soros-funded Antifa and Black Lives Matter activists in the front yards of formerly quiet neighborhoods around the country, which would in turn trigger new, already proposed gun control measures by the usual federal, city, and state authoritarian suspects, just in time and right on schedule. This sort of Hegelian dialectic change meets the end goals of the cult because their ultimate desire is to rule over a diminished global population. And that, too, is not conspiracy because the Malthusian dreams of the cult have been well documented literally for decades now and even etched right up there in the top slot of the Georgia Guidestones. Number one, quote, maintain humanity under 1/2 billion people in perpetual balance with nature, unquote. And guess who gets to live, folks, and who doesn't? Certainly, he says, the cult desires a culling of the herd, so to speak, yet with the permission of those willing to be so ruled. The aristocracy prefers servants and subjects, after all, and that would be the fate of the lower caste slaves who survive. So, he says, how might the cult of power get a majority of the plebs to willingly surrender? First, by activating their fear and survival instincts, and then showing them just how effective China's authoritarian lockdowns have been. Don't you want to be just like the communist Chinese? And here he gets to a point that I think is really worth focusing on for a minute. If American society continues to sink past the point of no return, I'd not be surprised, said Doug Lynn, if any future vaccinations might end up actually being voluntary instead of mandatory. Now, you got to understand, folks, it's often voluntary, meaning volunteer or else. Because, he writes, if these deluded Luciferians are actually playing some kind of cosmic chess match, they want people to choose death. And those who refuse to fall in with them would, as a result, suffer societal ostracization, economic isolation, starvation, and, yeah, ultimately, death. The vaccine deniers, here's another one of those registered trademarks, would then occupy the lowest caste in the New World Order registered trademark. They would be the new untouchables, and that certainly does seem like the obvious intent here. So he says there's no denying the fix is in, or that the media and tech titans are now colluding with the cult. So if you're not a coincidence theorist, is it just possible to see that COVID-1984 is yet another blitz by the political left to destroy a system they wanted dead anyway, and that's been followed up by the George Floyd insurrection and riots? There's a big lesson here, and I'll suggest that those who can't open their eyes and see it are very shortly going to be in one heap of a lot of trouble.